Welcome to Cybersecurity Insights, the podcast for the cybered.io learning community. Our goal is to bring cybersecurity practitioners the latest and most relevant education and training to upskill and dive deeper into topics that matter in today's modern cybersecurity world.
Good day, everyone. This is Steve King. I'm the managing director here at cybered.io. And today on our podcast, we're happy to be hosting Jared Atkinson, who's the chief strategist, Spectre Ops. Jared's a security researcher who specializes in DFIR, that's digital forensics and incident response, for those of you in our audience who don't know. He has been building and leading private sector HOT operations for a while, and in his previous life, he led incident response missions for the U.S. Air Force on team specializing in detecting and removing APTs on Air Force and Department of Defense networks. He's a PowerShell expert and open source guy, and is also the lead developer of Power Forensics, Uproot, and maintains a DFIR-focused blog at invoke-ir.com and a podcast called Detection Challenging Paradigms. So welcome, Jared. We're delighted to have you on the show today.
Thank you for having me, Steve. Appreciate it.
Sure. Let's start by telling me a little bit about what Spectre Ops does, if you don't mind.
Sure. Yeah, so Spectre Ops is a company. We're about seven years old. We started off kind of as a consultancy that was really focused, probably most well-known for red teaming. But we also had some defensive capabilities that I kind of led. And then we built out a product called Bloodhound Enterprise. So a lot of folks are probably familiar with Bloodhound, which is an open source tool. Generally, it's kind of the best way to describe it is it's Google Maps for working your way through enterprise network, specifically an Active Directory environment or an Azure environment. The open source version of Bloodhound started off as how do red teamers get from point A to point B during an operation? So I get initial access at computer A as user X, and I want to become a domain administrator or I want to access some resource. What's the kind of path for me to get from point A to point B? Our kind of enterprise product is focused on the inverse problem, which is as a defender, I don't know where the attacker is going to enter into my network, but I generally have an idea for what those important resources are and how do I limit access from any arbitrary point in the network to those important resources is the general idea. You think of it as a least privilege use case, but kind of approaching it from a very technical and like tangible perspective of access control and what users have access to what resources and that type of idea.
Yeah, so it's like a bloodhound in reverse or something, I guess.
Yeah, yep. Yeah, the I guess the idea is that bloodhound, think of it as the graph, which is the map of the, I call it the authentication landscape or access landscape.
Yeah.
And you could use it to go from point A to point B, or you can use it to say, I want to protect point B. What are all the different routes that anybody can take to get to point B? And then we could start to, you know, remediate or put security controls at those different choke points.
You have said that red team assessments are the wrong tool for testing the efficacy of security defenses. Yet, you know, they're incredibly popular and most people use them for that purpose. So what's your thesis on that?
Yeah, so it's not meant to be kind of a critique of red teaming as a whole. So I think there are definitely use cases where red teaming is the right approach. The problem is when we start to ask questions, for instance, let's say that I create some sort of security control, maybe a detection rule that says, I want to know if somebody has created a service for lateral movement, right? The problem with red teaming is that red teaming, generally speaking, is narrative driven, right? So there's a coherent story that has to be told to where the attacker has to achieve initial access, they have to privilege escalate, they have to laterally move, and they're trying to kind of execute some objective, right? And everything that they do in this chain of the attack has to make sense in the context of everything else that they do. And the problem is that for any kind of behavior that an attacker might implement, you could say an attack technique, there are numerous variations which they can choose from that would allow them to implement that behavior. And the problem is that during a red team, they're going to choose one or maybe a few different variations, but they're not going to test the full complement or what I would say is a representative sample of the set of possible variations. And so we get to a situation to where, let's say that you detect a red team, right? The question is does the fact that you detected the red team tell you that you would detect any arbitrary attacker that were to attack you? And the answer is no, it doesn't do that, right? Because you don't actually have enough data as part of the red team to be able to answer that question.
Give you a false sense of security, though.
Yeah, that would be definitely one danger of the red team, right? So if you detect a red team, the question is did you detect them because you have a comprehensive capability for detecting attacks? Or did you detect them because they happen to do the one thing that you were prepared to do? And it's just like everything. It's all about what data are you collecting and what conclusions are you able to draw as a result of that data.
Yeah, you just got lucky, maybe.
Yeah, exactly. You could have gotten lucky. And so the analogy that I like to draw is, let's say that you're training for a marathon. You would not use Usain Bolt's training plan. He's the fastest man on earth, right? But that's over 100 meters. And so his training plan is focused on trying to get you to be as fast as you can for a very short period of time. But if you're running a marathon, then you wouldn't be training optimally on his plan. And so that's kind of like my analogy for red teaming is, it's not that red teaming is bad. It's the kind of wrong protocol, let's say, for trying to evaluate the efficacy of security controls. That could be preventative controls, such as any prevention that you might put in place from an EDR or just from a configuration perspective, or detective controls, which are like, let's alert when this behavior occurs.
Right. Most of our audience understands what a red team is and and generally what a blue team is and what they do with their purposes, but not many understand purple teams. Can you give us a kind of a quick explanation for what purple teams do and what their major use case and usefulness are?
Yep. Yeah. And so this may be a little controversial, but I'll give you kind of like my definition and I'll explain how I got there. Right. So there, the general gist, the like super high level perspective is purple is a mix of red and blue working together to achieve some objective. And like, if you ask a lot of people, that's kind of the answer that they give. But the question is what is the objective that they're trying to achieve? Making the network more secure, maybe. But the more important question is how are they trying to achieve that, right? So great, it's red and blue working together, but what are they actually trying to do? And that's the problem, I think, with these kind of abstract titles like red teaming, blue teaming, purple teaming, is we have a tendency to talk past each other because we're not actually getting down to like a concrete level of description. We just kind of say, oh, it's purple teaming, and everybody's like, oh yeah, cool. And so the way that we describe purple teaming, and this is based on, I kind of did an analysis of a bunch of different people's definitions. So I tried to find as many kind of definitions of purple teaming as I could. And then I pulled out some common like themes across all those different definitions. And we kind of came down to this statement. So purple teaming is the evaluation of security control efficacy through atomic testing using deliberately selected test cases. And we could break down all those concepts even further if we're interested. But the big question is I'm building security controls which are, you know, supposed to stop certain things from happening or alert if certain things happen. How do I know that when the rubber hits the road, they'll actually work as I designed them to?
Yeah. And now you need to describe for everyone what atomic testing is.
Sure. Yeah, so like the general idea behind atomic testing, and this is a lot of folks might be familiar with, Red Canary has something called Atomic Red Team, and that it's probably not like a unique concept in general, but within cybersecurity, it was kind of a game changer a little bit. And the general idea is when we approach problems from a scientific point of view, what we try to do is we try to control variables, right? And one of the big issues that we kind of laid out with this red teaming approach is that it's a coherent narrative that includes necessarily this entire attack chain. And the problem is that the fact that what you're doing fits into an attack chain is actually constraining in the sense that you don't have as much freedom of selection of what you're going to do because it all has to make sense with each other. Atomic testing is saying, let's extract the individual behavior from that overall chain, and let's just test it in a kind of in a vacuum, so to speak. And so like you might be saying, I want to build a detection to identify when somebody uses process injection. And so what you would do is you would say, I don't care what they did leading up to the process injection. I don't care what they did after the process injection. I want to just run that process injection and then evaluate the result.
Which parts of the kill chain, if you will, do you find yield the most interesting results?
It's a great question. I think there's kind of a, this is my personal opinion. I think there's a little bit of a, so it's probably true, but it's not practical is what I'm going to go for. But a lot of people say the earlier in the kill chain you build your detection or your preventative control, the better off you are. And I think that literally makes sense in the from the perspective of if you could stop somebody from gaining initial access, then you're in a better spot than if you're stopping somebody from exfiltrating data, let's say. But one of the problems is the number of possible kind of primitives, I guess, or options that attackers have early, like at that initial access phase. There's so many more variables that you have to control that it makes it very difficult to kind of have a comprehensive solution. When we start talking about specifically post-exploitation, so after the attacker gains initial access to your network, maybe they gain it through phishing or all kinds of different opportunities, but they get access to your system. Well, typically the system that they first have access to is not the end goal. So they have to kind of work their way through the network. That's kind of that Bloodhound use case that I talked about earlier.
Yeah.
And as part of that, there's certain things they have to do, like lateral movement, for instance. The good thing about lateral movement is that there's actually a very constrained set of options that attackers have to go from, I have code executing on computer A, I need to get to computer B. There's not an infinite number of options for me to use to do that. And so things like, how do I move from computer A to computer B? We call that lateral movement. How do I change the context of user that I'm operating in? So how do I take over some other user's identity? That's called like credential access, right? So we have a relatively constrained set of opportunities there. How do I go from just a normal user account on a system to the admin account, which would be like privilege escalation? There's a relatively small subset of options there. And so those are kind of like the three major tactic categories, I would say, that I think are really good options for kind of building detections around, because generally because they have to happen and there's a constrained set of options for attackers to work with them.
In any part of your background, did you work as a hacker, as a, darker side?
No. So like I actually was a history major in college, and then I joined the Air Force, and somebody fat fingered my degree code. History was in the Air Force. They use alphanumeric numbers codes for everything. History was 0 golf, Yankee, Yankee. So 0 GYY. Computer science was 0 Charlie, Yankee, Yankee. So 0 CYY. And somebody fat-fingered it, and they thought I was a computer science guy, and so they put me into cybersecurity. In the training, we did lots of, like, hacking training, but I was never, like, properly doing hacking as a real job or anything.
That's a great story, though. That's great. Yeah.
Whoever did that is kind of, like, my hero in life because they...
Well, I think there's a lot of history majors in cybersecurity, actually.
Yeah.
And that ain't all bad, right?
We're really good at consuming information and being able to kind of like pull out themes and ideas and that kind of thing. I think that's really a skill that you learn in history, is like you got to read a lot of books and then kind of summarize them and pull out the important tidbits from kind of what you learned from whatever topic.
It may be the last bastion of critical thinking.
Potentially, yeah.
Hey, so let me ask you completely off the wall, out of the domain question here. You know, I look at all of the sort of point solutions that are very popular, from an XDR, let's say, point of view, and mm-hmm. you're a network guy. So, and we've been doing network-centric cybersecurity defense for a long, long time. And I don't know, you know, the published average, you know, detection to, or infection to detection is 277 days, whether it's that or whether it's 27 days or 2.5 days. Aren't we missing the point? I mean, why?
Great question.
We're always way to the right. I skip, pardon the expression, but way to the right of bang. We never move to the left of bang. We never look at it from an identity, a device, application point of view. Are we doing this wrong?
Yeah. I don't want to like sound too shilly for the Bloodhound Enterprise thing that we're going on, but one of the things that we've realized, so Bloodhound Enterprise, we've kind of created this category or this story around what we call attack path management. So that there's this idea that when an attacker gains access to an environment, there's a certain number of paths. Imagine that you're like on Google Maps and you're trying to go from Los Angeles to New York. There's a certain number of routes that you could choose, that physical routes on roads and things like that. And Google Maps is doing is giving you the shortest route, ideally, right? And maybe you have some different types of features like avoid toll roads and things like that. So it's not literally the shortest route, but it's going to give you the most efficient route within the context of what you're asking for. One of the things that we're doing with attack path management is we're trying to project all of the routes that an attacker would have from any arbitrary system to the systems that you care about. We call them tier zero assets. So those would be things like the domain controller, but it's much more complicated than that. And so the real idea here is, can we stop people from getting, like, can we get rid of these routes, right? We don't necessarily need the routes. And when you take it back all the way to its origin, what we kind of realized is that this is least privilege is what we're talking about. So we all know the principle of least privilege. In fact, I looked it up and I found the original white paper where least privilege was introduced. And it was introduced in, I believe, July of 1974. So the principle of least privilege was introduced 50 years ago. And based on our experience with tons of customers in this Bloodhound Enterprise kind of approach, there's not a single customer that introduces Bloodhound Enterprise and is not surprised by the results of what they find. And this, like, the same is true with Bloodhound, like the free and open source version. So like, you don't have to buy the product to see this, but nobody's not surprised. And so the idea of least privilege is, it's in the military, we talk about like positive control. And so the idea is that you don't just arrive at least privilege by accident, right? If you're surprised by something, like by access to tier zero, some ability for an attacker to get access to your domain controller, let's say, or the domain admin's user group in Windows. If you're surprised by it, you don't have least privilege, because you can't have least privilege unless you've accepted risk, for instance, right? So least is weird because, like, you know, you have to say, what is the actual least privilege? But if you're surprised by something, then it's not integrated into that concept of least. And so we're really pushing for kind of reducing your exposure as far as attack paths. I would say like the origin of that, because when in my bio you talked about I was doing a bunch of stuff in the Air Force. One of the things that we found in the Air Force is a lot of times security teams don't have access to impose like security, like preventative security controls, right? And so detection, I personally think the detection kind of came out of this thing of, I'm going to control what I have the ability to control. And so there's this idea of like, I have to go through all this bureaucracy and red tape to try to stop this thing from being possible. But what I can do, like, it's completely within my control to say, if this event happens, I'm going to create a detection. I'm going to investigate that. And so a lot of people have moved towards detection, but I think there's also a misnomer of just be like, detection is not the end of the line. So a lot of times people will like kind of, I don't know that people will say this literally, but they act as if this is true, that if my detection fires on a behavior, then I'm good to go. But the problem is, as we know, there's error in detection, right? So false positives would be a good example. And so you have to, like, if you don't detect it, you failed. But just because you detected it doesn't mean you succeeded. There's additional steps, which is, how do I, you know, take that detection through kind of the investigation or remediation phase to make sure that I actually do fix the issue or stop the issue. And I think a lot of times we focus too much on detection and not enough on making sure that we're able to shepherd that alert all the way through to remediation. So it's kind of like, yeah, go ahead.
No, you're right. And it's the remediation word is missing from DFIR, you know.
Yep.
And
yep.
It's unfortunate. But it reflects it reflects the sort of architectural thinking about network-centric defenses here.
You know, yeah.
We need forensics because we accepted the fact almost that we'll never see it coming. We'll only see it after it's here. And then,
yep.
you know, and once we see it, we're like, good to go, you know?
Yep.
That makes no sense, of course. But I'm conscious of the time. And so one other question I wanted to ask you was in Detection Challenging Paradigms, your podcast, what is the, in your estimation and your experience on the podcast, what is the biggest impactful, I guess, paradigm that is challenging detection?
Oh man. Okay. There's some good stuff that potentially we could pull out. I think one of the big ideas that I really try to push is our ability to solve a problem is limited by our understanding of that problem. Right. And so a lot of times people will try to create a solution without first understanding the complexity of the system in which they're trying to interact with. And that generally leads us to superficial solutions. And so like one example in a detection use case would be when people, so imagine that you're trying to detect service creation, right? So attackers, just for context, attackers will use Windows services for lateral movement. And the idea is that I can create a service on a remote system. I can execute that service, and that service could run my malicious code, which then gives me access to that system. And I've effectively moved from my initial system to this secondary system. And a lot of times people will create detection rules targeting specific built-in software like sc.exe. And what they'll do is they'll say, okay, well, I want to see anytime a process is created where the software executed, the process name is sc.exe, and the command line includes /create, right? This is kind of, it's a little bit of a, I'm making it more simple than it typically is, but it's true enough, I think, to make it work. Yeah, but what they're skipping is the fact that there's this whole infrastructure that undergirds sc.exe. There's, for instance, each operating system has API functions, right? And there's an API function called create service W that somebody might call. But under that, there's an RP. There's something called remote procedure calls, and there's an RPC procedure called R create service W. And so the idea is that if you focus at the what I call the tool layer, so this sc.exe, you're closing down your perspective from anybody who's going to veer off that course and implement their own tool or kind of execute at a lower level of abstraction. And that causes us, again, to have kind of that false sense of security because we don't actually understand the complexity of what's going on.
Yeah. Well, yeah, that's exactly correct. And, we've been trumpeting that over here for quite a while. And and that's why, you know, we started cyber.io. All right, Jared, it's been cool. I appreciate it. And it's a great topic. And I hope folks got a little something out of this because if you don't open the box, you know, you can't ever see inside, right?
That's correct. 100%. 100%.
All right.
Awesome. Thank you, Steve.
Thank you, man. And thank you to our listeners. And until next time, I'm Steve King, your host, signing off.
Thank you for joining us for another episode of Cybersecurity Insights. You can connect with us on LinkedIn or Facebook or send us an email at social@cybered.io. For more information about the podcast, visit cybered.io/podcast. Until next week, stay safe and secure, and we'll see you on the next episode of Cybersecurity Insights.